Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Graphic novelist Craig Thompson turned his strict Christian upbringing movingly inside out in his 2003 hit book, Blankets. Lots of Wisconsin snow and ultimately lots of love. This time out, he's gone Arabian Nights, a whole new world, or old, it's not clear. Sultans, harems, slaves, deserts, and a harsh industrial dystopia with love and Arabic and a thread of Islam right at the heart of it. Verses from the Bible and Quran side by side. It's a deep, beautiful, hard-edged story about survival and the redeeming power of love. This hour On Point, Craig Thompson's Habibi. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for this, to see another Western cartoonist, graphic novelist, step into the realm of Islam, Arabia? Are you a Craig Thompson fan? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Craig Thompson, Harvey and Eisner award-winning graphic novelist, author of the widely acclaimed 2003 graphic novel Blankets, as well as Goodbye Chunky Rice and Carnet de Voyage. His new book, 7 years in the making, nearly 700 pages, is Habibi. It means beloved in Arabic. Craig Thompson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom, for inviting me.
It's great to have you. This is a great, big, amazing journey of a book. We're going to be joined later in this hour by a Muslim religious scholar, just to think about it together. But I wish you'd do us a favor and just give us an outline of this story. It's nearly 700 pages. It's big. It's complex. But take us to the heart of the story so we can understand what you've been working on, Craig.
Well, yes, it's 700 pages. It's sort of a mashup of the sacred medium of holy books like the Quran and the Bible with the vulgar pulp medium of comic books. Both of these were the two literatures that influenced me most as a child.
It looks almost like a Quran, its exterior. You've really fallen in love with the Arabic script and language and motifs of the Islamic world.
Definitely. That was the whole visual inspiration. All these Arabic calligraphy and the Islamic arts, the ornamentation and the geometric design, architecture, all these things were fueled it most of all visually.
Give us a thumbnail version of the big story that runs through this amazing book.
Well, there's two characters, Dodola and Zam. It's really about their relationship. Zam talks about 7 layers of heaven above and 7 layers of hell below and a 15th layer in the center where all of human existence takes place. And that layer is a battleground. And that's how I thought of the book. The emotional core is that 15th layer is the relationship between Dodola and Zam, these escaped child slaves. And everything else is just layers of heaven and hell heaped on top of them.
Dodola is somewhere in a kind of Arabian setting. It's hard at first to tell what the time is. It's hard throughout to tell what the time is. Sometimes it's all sultans and harems, and it looks like Ottoman Empire. Other times it looks like, industrial hell right now, or maybe even worse in the future. She's sold very young by her desperate parents, 9 years old or so, into marriage to a scribe who does lots of beautiful Arabic calligraphy. She learns that there, what is captured by slave traders, he's sold. She's brought off to Anatolia, auctioned off. But she meets this abandoned, she's Semitic, Arabian, she meets this abandoned kind of African child, toddler at that point, Habibi. And theirs is the love story at the heart of this, Craig.
Exactly. You did a better job of summing it up than I could.
Here they are. And you've got this wonderful time where they are out in the desert in this sort of mystical, abandoned ship, boat. Nobody could, it's hard to picture how it would ever be there in the middle of the desert. They spend years together where she, as a girl, is raising him as a toddler, and she's telling him stories. It gives you a chance to kind of, unravel or unfold the stories that you have clearly studied to do this book from the world of Islam.
Yeah, I mean, Dodola is a Scheherazade sort. She tells stories for survival, only it's less for her own beheading. It's for the sake of this little child, this orphan, Zam. And she's interweaving stories, biblical and Quranic stories, throughout their own narrative. And for me, that was about exploring the connections between the Abrahamic faiths, because in a sort of, when I was looking into Islam for the first time, I was struck first with all the similarities with the Christian upbringing I had. It was the same morals, the same lifestyles, and maybe most importantly, the same stories and characters that shape these faiths.
Literally, Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and so on.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, they share the same father in Abraham, and where there's slight divergences in the stories, where the rivers part, it's fun to explore those connections too, or those divergences. But in the end, they all flow from the same source.
Tell us about that upbringing of yours. People who've read Blankets will know a lot about it, semi-autobiographical, about your pretty tough fundamentalist upbringing in rural Wisconsin and how love sort of gave you a thread out of it. How much a part of your life was scripture and biblical story?
All of it. I grew up in a very like evangelical Christian family. And on the good side of that, there's an element of evangelical Christianity, which is not about labels. It's not about denominations. But then there's another part of it, this born-again culture, that sort of rejects other forms of Christianity. So I was raised with believing that Catholics and Lutherans were going to hell because they didn't have a true relationship with Jesus. So I think that part of that faith shaped a lot of boundaries between people. This is one of the things I'm trying to counteract with Habibi, that in the same way that Christians can sometimes set up separations between their denominations, they do it with other religions too, Judaism and Islam. And I think real spirituality is about bringing down those boundaries that are kind of constructed by humans.
You're pretty free with boundaries. You were in Blankets. You've got, you know, Jesus depicted there on pages right alongside sexuality, nude woman. In this book, there's plenty of sex in here as well. This is not a children's book. It's discreet in its way. But did you feel hesitation about stepping into that terrain when you've got the language, the script of Arabic, the language and stories of Islam also woven through here? Was that intimidating for you?
Well, as I said before, it's a mashup of sorts between holy books and comic books, which are this kind of vulgar medium. It's a meditation on the sacred and profane and this like human ugliness with spiritual beauty. And the relationship between words and pictures. And so I didn't want to shy away from that on any given page. In fact, I wanted to amplify the juxtaposition of something that might be perceived as vulgar, like a sensual image with sacred imagery.
You're surely aware, who wouldn't be, of you know how the sort of the Islamic world went really up in arms after the famous Danish newspaper publishing cartoons back in 2005. I mean, you know this is can be a minefield. Did you think about that? Did you care?
Well, I think that intent makes a big difference. The Danish cartoons that keep being referred to were deliberately provocative, at times insulting. And this was coming from a different place. I had a circle of Muslim friends and readers who I was consulting, and they sort of emboldened me because they knew I was coming from a place of reverence and respect for these stories. I was trying to be sensitive, especially around, more delicate subjects.
I've never seen quite this kind of deep investigation of Arabic script, and of course that's very, very important in Islam itself. You come at it as a graphic artist, a graphic novelist. You're sort of deconstructing Arabic. You're writing a lot of Arabic. I don't know if you read it or understand it. You've got lots of it in here, but you're also clearly fascinated with the origins of it, the kind of maybe anthropomorphic origins in there, the aesthetic of that script itself. What did that mean to you?
Well, Chris Ware, a fairly well-known cartoonist, talks about comics as pictures that you read, whereas this Arabic calligraphy are words that you can look at, that you can purely appreciate for their visual aesthetics, their fluidity, their musicality. In fact, they've been described that way, as music for the eyes. That really resonates for me as a cartoonist. And I don't read or write Arabic, and people ask that often. I relied a lot on the circle of friends who were fluent in Arabic as consultants. But you know, learning Arabic calligraphy is a lifetime discipline, whereas I'm just trying to make a comic book, you know. It would be quite a divergence. But, as a cartoonist, I think one of the things is that in my drawings, I'm also aiming for fluidity and this handwritten quality, a cursive quality. To me, Arabic is one of the most beautiful visual languages because of that fluid, cursive musicality.
Is there a worldview implicit in that graphic presentation of the language?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know how to define it, though, but it's something that flows. There's a clunkiness to our Romanized English letters, and but there's a fluidity in both that the sonic or the verbal language, and maybe even more so in its visual representation.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great graphic novelist Craig Thompson about his new cosmic, hard-edged Arabian Nights-style love story, Habibi. He joins us today from San Francisco. Habibi means beloved. You may have read his book Blankets, big in 2003. This one's nearly 700 pages, very much in the kind of Arabian Nights calligraphic and environmental style here. Where it's set? Hard to say. Past, future, right now, sultans, harems, slave girl, a love story at the heart of it, also industrial waste all around it. Kind of mashup, he's saying today, telling us today, of the holy and the vulgar. We'll be joined in just a moment by Zarina Graywall, who's really thought a lot about Islam and cultures meeting. A couple calls first. David in Somerville, Massachusetts. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call, and it's a pleasure to speak with you and with Mr. Thompson. Mm-hmm. My question pertains to the subject of Orientalism that I think you mentioned just previously. Mm-hmm. I know Mr. Thompson is from Wisconsin. I've read Blankets. I've also read already 600 pages, 700 pages plus of Habibi. My question centers around somewhat his own upbringing, just native culture. To what degree does he feel he was successful, or how did he navigate around stereotypes? You said that he's including, of course, harems, sheep, not the oil concerns, but certainly water concerns,
mm-hmm.
and injecting it with his own views on sensuality, sexuality, and how that works with religion. I'd be curious to hear from him how he includes all these things that he feels are important parts of this story, are pivotal parts of this story, without inviting in an audience that only knows the Middle East through Aladdin and only knows the Middle East through Arabian Nights, seeing mm-hmm. it as exotic and other.
It's a great question. Central question, David. Thanks very much. Craig Thompson, begin to take us in there. That's a big one, but what about it? This is clear.
Yeah.
This is in that realm. This is that kind of Orientalist Arabian Nights presentation. How do you think about that? And its potential upside or downside?
Well, thanks for that question, David. Yeah, Orientalism at its worst, of course, shapes prejudice. It was something I had to meditate on because as a quote-unquote outsider looking in on another culture— I was sort of processing, sort of self-consciousness and American guilt over our role in the world. But, in French Orientalist paintings, for instance, it sensationalizes and eroticizes other cultures. But always there's this theme of defining someone else as the other, which is something we do in all relationships, for the worst, I would say. We're prone to do that. We eroticize, we define someone as the other, we project an image onto them, and we separate them from themselves. We create these imagined boundaries. So East and West, those are imagined boundaries, male and female to some degree. And of course, separating the religions too. So it's a meditation on all those sort of things. I wanted to bring in this sort of generic tropes of Arabian Nights in a very self-conscious way.
But if you... if you're meditating on it for nearly 700 pages, if you bring in the tropes, how do you avoid falling victim to exactly those downsides? Edward Said, the great scholar, wrote about Orientalism, called it a dogma that not only degrades its subject matter, but also blinds its practitioners. How do you work with this material without falling, you know, subject to those problems yourself, Craig?
Again, I was mentioning romantic relationships and how we have this tendency to also define our partner as the other. I don't know if I can separate some of the Orientalism in the book from the sexuality or lusts of Zam. And I don't want to change the subject here, but I think there's as much meditation on sort of male guilt as American guilt, and that Zam is turning Dodola into an object of lust, into an idol. Somehow I think the two are interconnected, this eroticizing and this imagined separation.
We should say here, for listeners who haven't, like David, managed to crack the book, Dodola and Zam are out in the desert on this boat. They're eating. Ultimately, the way they do it is she is selling herself to passing caravans to get food, to raise him. He ultimately learns this, sees a bit of it, is shocked by it, just at the age where he's feeling his own erotic stirrings. They're separated. She ends up in a harem. He has a long journey of his own. They come back together. The love story is right there, but it's right there woven in with all, as Craig Thompson says, the tropes of Orientalism and lots of allusions to the Abrahamic faiths and Islam at the same time. Craig Thompson, stand by in San Francisco, if you would. I want to bring in right now to join us from Princeton, New Jersey, Zarina Graywall. She's an assistant professor of American Studies, Religious Studies at Yale University. She's a historical anthropologist, documentary filmmaker, writes on the intersection of race and religion in American Muslim communities, teaches courses on Muslims in America, U.S. culture and political interests in the Middle East, ethnographic and documentary film. Zarina Graywall, it's terrific to have you with us here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You look at this as, I presume, as a scholar and a Muslim and a documentary filmmaker yourself. You've looked at Habibi. What do you think?
Yes. Fascinating read. I mean, it's extraordinary text, very compelling, very complicated. I loved it, and yet part of me is troubled by it. So I have some ambivalence, but I think it's an extraordinary work, and I'm just so impressed with Craig Thompson.
Describe your ambivalence. I mean, his own parents were pretty ambivalent about his first work that had a lot about Christianity in it. Craig, you've said that they told you that your work was satanic. Where's your ambivalence come from here, Zarina?
Well, my ambivalence is not religious. My ambivalence is political. I think that just to pick up on the conversation that you were having earlier about Orientalism and the stereotypes, you know, is there an inversion of stereotypes? I certainly think this is not an irreverent book. I mean, clearly, this is he's really laboring towards trying to do a sympathetic portrayal of Islam, and there's a lot of dignity in the characters, and I appreciate that. But this book is not about Islam. In this book, Islam is a means to an end. And that's not to say that it's an apolitical book, but the political message of the book is not about Islam. It's about, global economic disparities. It's about race. It's about gender. And so I think for me, I guess my ambivalence is simply that, you know, in a moment when Islam is so politicized and racialized, to use it only as a source of kind of aesthetic inspiration. I mean, really what he's drawing on Islam here for is as kind of building blocks for the story. It's aesthetics, it's mythology, and he does it in an incredibly complex and beautiful way. There's just certain points in the story where, you know, there's moments in the story where I just wish there was just a little bit of a political edge and a little bit more of a political consciousness to the ways in which he's using the stereotypes. It feels less of an inversion of stereotypes and more just like a purposeful and deliberate lingering on the positive elements of those stereotypes or the beautiful elements of those exotic imagery.
Craig Thompson?
Well, first off, it's a great honor to talk with Zarina. Thank you. Yeah, it's totally true and fair to say that it's not about religion or Islam. I think that's kind of veering off the course of what I was saying earlier of this relationship primarily between Dodola and Zam, which is complex. I think going back to what I was saying with this eroticization, is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the book, the reader is sort of seeing Dodola through Zam's eyes, and this is shaped by lust. As the author, I was self-conscious that, you know, this was sexist in a sense. But I wanted the reader to be in his shoes, and again to show how this eroticization was so much about seeing her as something outside of himself, seeing her as this sacred idol, a form of idolatry which is forbidden in both Islam and Christianity.
But you've got. I have to say, I do find plenty of Islam or Islamic stories here. Those are the stories, the sacred stories that she tells Zam when they're in the desert. And you dive deeply into them, looking at these the sort of deep roots shared by Islam and Judaism and Christianity here. I mean, we've got Abraham late in the book with Isaac and Ishmael in your telling depiction here, you know, on the altar, one of them maybe to be sacrificed to God. Of course, we know that story goes they're not in the end, but he's looking up through the talking about Muhammad's lineage and the lineage of Jesus. There is a lot of religion woven through and alongside the love story, the dystopia, the sexual relationship. It's not as though it's not here, Craig.
Yeah, but you'd never see a clearly defined religious ritual, for instance, in these characters. Their actual religious faith is never set. It's just that they live in this sort of vaguely Muslim landscape. But even then, I hesitate towards that label because Allah and God's same difference.
But Zarina, do you think as this goes out into the world, and I mean it's quite a story, and it's really something to read? Do you think that the Muslim world will make the distinctions that you're making here today, saying yes, lots of Islamic iconography, maybe the stories, but it's not about Islam, and it doesn't offend Islam?
Well, I would say this. First of all, Muslims, like Christians, believe their tradition is a universal tradition, mm-hmm. and that their book, therefore, should be a source of inspiration and it has the power to inspire anyone who reads it. And so, I think that Craig Thompson here has taken Quranic stories and has done his own reading of them through this text. And there's other American artists that are doing similar projects. Sando Burke's American Quran, he's a painter who basically picked up the Quran and, just did his own painting of each chapter of it without necessarily studying it is with the depth that Craig did. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a lot of artists in America who are trying to come at Islam from a sort of their own point of view, and I think that that in and of itself is fine and welcome. It's not a problem. I think the question of the reception of the book. The comparison, of course, is always being made to the Danish cartoon controversy, which I think in some ways is a false comparison. Mm-hmm. We might also compare this book to The 99, which is an incredibly popular comic book series, which also is takes an Islamic myth and sort of the 99 names of God and the powers of God and turns them into superpowers and superheroes, these 99 different superheroes. That's an extraordinarily popular series in the Middle East. And actually, there's a theme park in Kuwait. They wanted to do a cartoon here, I think, on the Discovery Channel. There's several people who have mm-hmm. sort of militated against that, so it's been pulled off the air. But so it's doing a similar thing. It's much less complex. I think that is very popular in the Middle East because it's empowering youth. That's the whole message. This is not about. I don't think this will be popular for Middle Eastern audiences or Muslim audiences in the Muslim world. But I think this is really geared towards American audiences. And I think that for me, I found it very compelling. So I don't think it's going to, I don't think there's probably not going to be riots over this, but it's also not going to be a bestseller in Egypt.
Let's go to Douglas calling from Montreal in Canada. Douglas, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I just like to, I really appreciate his point of view, coming from the evangelical community myself, I see that there's been a tremendous change over the years toward from division to inclusiveness. That within the Protestant church that I'm in, we no longer hear, there's some people here who no longer see other denominations or other groups within denominations as being outside of our group. We see them as someone who makes our group, the whole, better than it was, that they have something unique to offer to the whole. Say whether it be Orthodox or Roman Catholicism, or whether it be the Mennonites, the Quakers, the Baptists, the Anglicans, or the Pentecostals, I think there's a movement within the church now is looking at these other groups as being having a unique, important contribution to the health of the whole and having something unique to offer, as opposed to something which is not a part of themselves because they have a doctrinal difference.
Douglas, that is a very welcome message. Craig Thompson, how do you see that? What are you telling us here with the resonance you depict between these different Abrahamic faiths anyway? Maybe almost even a Hindu allusion in here at one point, I think. But what are you telling us with the interweaving, Craig?
Well, I would extend that from what Douglas is describing of not just denominations of Christianity, but all religions. And for myself, and maybe for the characters in the book, I'm more inspired by sort of esoteric takes on the different Abrahamic faiths. So Sufism and Gnosticism and Kabbalah. For me, some of those are less about dogma and more about a static view of divinity and sort of breaking down boundaries.
Did you see that, Zarina, in Craig's work here in Habibi?
Absolutely, and it's done with such skill and sensitivity. I really commend him on that. So, you know, for scripturalist Muslims, they're not going to recognize the Islam that's represented in the book, I don't think. But the usage of the Quranic narratives. I mean, by the way, the Old Testament stories that make mm-hmm. their way into the Quran are much more politically correct than so they're not. I should say that the book has a lot of sex and it has a sort of exoticizing element, but it's exotic without being erotic. I mean, it's not titillating. There's a real, very serious argument being made about the nature of desire, its destructive potential, its liberating potential, and so. I would say that, you know, the Quranic stories in the narrative function as kind of a source of resilience and inspiration for the characters, and I think that in that sense, I don't think people would object to the juxtaposition.
No question, it's about resilience. But there must have been moments where I don't know, but where you as a Muslim must have, oh boy, this is getting the eros pretty close to divine here.
Well. You know, I mean, you have to also understand that, you know, the Quran itself has a lot of sensual and sexual imagery. I would say that, you know, I mean, look, I wouldn't put a there is a tradition. There are traditions within Islam of depicting prophets. But the point is that the accounts of those prophets are not nearly as, I don't know, rated R as they are in the Old Testament. So that's one element. I mean, for me personally, I wouldn't put a photo of a drawing of a prophet up in my house. But you know, in reading this text and understanding his point of view, it didn't bother me.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with graphic novelist Craig Thompson about his new cosmic scale, hard-edged Arabian Nights love story, Habibi. He's the author, the drawer of Blankets and Goodbye Chunky Rice and Carnet de Voyage. Habibi, now out, beloved, it means in Arabic, at nearly 700 pages, joins us today from San Francisco. And Zarina Graywall is with us from Yale University, assistant professor there of American Studies and Religious Studies, directed and produced the film By the Dawn's Early Light, Chris Jackson's Journey to Islam, about scrutiny of American Muslims' patriotism after 9/11. Deborah in Lincoln, Vermont. Deborah, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I'm just very excited to hear about this book. I haven't cracked it open yet. I just heard about it today via this show, so I'm grateful for that. but I'm mostly calling to say that I'm excited because of the words that Craig is using as he describes his approach, that he's reverent, for one thing, and that he's really trying to do something both with the Arabic calligraphy in terms of that visual appreciation, in terms of sharing the stories, both biblical and Quranic, which have the same root, and that nesting storytelling, which is so beautiful in the Muslim culture. And also this, and I think even most primarily, the examination of what is the other. And I haven't read the book yet, so I don't know about the sexualization or the politicization of this subject, but I just want to say thank you. I hope that I read it soon. I think he might be doing a great service to especially to Western culture at this point, as it's written in English, that we might have some greater windows onto the sameness of the other and maybe examining our own feelings about that.
Deborah, I appreciate your call. Craig Thompson, are you trying to teach us about the other here or to make the other less other?
Both, I believe. And I like what Zarina said, or I respond to what Zarina said earlier about this probably being less for Muslims in Egypt and more for Americans. It is processing, you know, American guilt in this sense of how our imperialist culture sort of feeds off of, you know, other cultures, poverty in other nations. I think a lot of it is speaking self-awareness towards locals and Orientalism, you know, re-examining it, it's not even being re-examined to some degree because it's as prominent as ever. I mean, Islamophobia in the States is a new wave, a huge wave of Orientalism.
Here's a question for you online, Craig. Kevin says that you stated the Danish cartoons were intentionally provocative, insulting. He says, true, but so what? When did something that is insulting deserve less protection than something that is safe? And would you have not put out this work if you talked with your circle of Muslim friends, if they had found something objectionable, would you have changed it or not put out the book? Kevin asked Craig.
That's a great question. I mean, you know, I struggle with that a bit with First Amendment rights. Obviously, I believe in them and I think they're important. I get frustrated that sometimes some of our legal resources get wasted on things that aren't really important artistically. So, a lot of resources around First Amendment rights all get poured into protecting something that is deliberately vulgar or provocative. And so all these more examined artistic works get kind of sidelined. But in terms of my relationships with my Muslim friends that were acting as consultants on Habibi, there were a few times that I shied away from things that they recommended against. But a lot of the time they would say, well, some people are going to have a problem with this. I personally don't. And admittedly, a lot of them were more liberal in their political leanings. But they're like, some people are going to have a problem, just so you know. And I was like, okay, I'll go forward with it.
And of course, then there's Islam itself, which, you know, does not go in a sacred setting. Zarina, correct me if I get off track here, but mm-hmm. in a sacred setting for depictions of humans, or certainly not of the divine, in your very beautiful Orphan's Prayer late in the book, Craig. And this is page after page with almost no illustration. But you quote, the Quran saying, "He who makes images will suffer the harshest punishment on the day of resurrection." That must be a pretty tough passage for a graphic novelist, Greg.
Yeah, it's not from the Quran. It's actually a hadith. And that's one of the fallacies, too, is that there really is no Quranic prohibition, as far as I know, of image making. Is that true, Zarina?
That's correct. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the Danish cartoon controversy got spun as Muslims don't get cartoons, Muslims don't mm-hmm. do cartoons, it's a taboo, and that's simply not the case. I mean, if you look at pre-modern Muslim art, there are plenty of, especially in the Shia tradition, there are plenty of depictions of even Muhammad himself. Right now, if you want to see a picture of Muhammad, you can go to the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Building and see Muhammad in a frieze with a bunch of other historic lawmakers, and there wasn't a riot over it. You know, in fact, Muslim groups did actually ask for the frieze, that to him to be removed from the frieze, and the court ruled against it, and nothing happened. So it's not that, like, every time there's a depiction of Muhammad that Muslims don't like, people die and violence happens. I mean, that's simply not the case. The Danish cartoon controversy was a manufactured crisis, and it happened over, you know, over the course of almost 18 months that it played out.
But this tradition of avoiding the image, I mean, to go on with that hadith, it says every painter will go to hell, and for every portrait he's made, there will be appointed one who will chastise him in hell. There is this, can you just explain the philosophy of it, why that has been, if not religiously, then certainly culturally avoided in some degree?
No. Of course, there is a debate within Islam about the status of images. Now, and certainly Muslims take the no graven images commandment very, mm-hmm. very seriously. Mm-hmm. So, and there are no depictions of God in this text.
It verges on idolatry, I guess, is the caution.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so, of course, that's certainly the case. That would be one small critique, if I could make, of the book, is that although Islam is represented in a very complex way, it's represented as complex and beautiful, and the focus is on the aesthetics, the complexity of the mythology and the complexity of the aesthetics, not on the debates. So there actually is a very complex debate about representation and paint and, you know, drawing figures and all that stuff. Those kinds of debates don't make their way into the book. I think that and actually any debates about slavery, I wish that since so much of the book is about slavery and sex, gender, women's rights, the kind of social justice element of the Quran is actually noticeably absent in the book. His focus is really on the sort of mystical, divine, the status of desire, other kinds of themes. And I think it's beautifully done, but that's just a gap that I think would have maybe added another layer.
Craig, what do you say if you left out the social justice element?
I don't know if I deliberately left it out. Slavery to some degree is permitted in all the Abrahamic faiths, so that's something all of us have to examine. And the same with the prohibition of graven images. I mean, they're forbidden in all the Abrahamic faiths. So it's strange that Christianity and Judaism have evolved in the way they have. They're all starting from the same set of laws. But in terms of, slavery, I mean, it's something that's... I don't have a direct message in there. You know, that's not really the role of art to provide an answer. It's more about inviting questions. So slavery is there from the beginning, the first page of the book, to almost the last page of the book, because slavery is more prominent in our culture or in our world than ever before in the history of mankind. So even though
you're
we've kind of...
trafficking and that whole realm.
Human trafficking, mm-hmm. There might be new labels for all of it, indentured mm-hmm. servitude, a globalization. But we sort of like sequestered this idea that, that was something from our past, and yet it's more prominent than ever. So I didn't know if I had a message other than that.
Slavery and redemption in Craig Thompson's Habibi. Let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Fawad. Fawad, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
No problem. Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. My name is Fawad Siddiqui. I'm an actor, cartoonist, and comics historian. I've been doing research on the subject of Muslim characters in comics for about 10 or 12 years or so. I started while I was working at a comic book store in college toward a blog or a book or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I just wanted to comment that this genre of Muslims in comics is actually a lot more active than one might think, both in terms of Muslims' appearances in mainstream American comics, like Batman, Superman, and the X-Men, which recently had a X-Men in full burqa.
X-Men in burqa. All right.
Yeah, her name is Dust. She was created in 2002 in the pages of Marvel Comics to a bit of fanfare. More recently in Marvel Comics, the wielder of the sword Excalibur is a Pakistani-British doctor named Faiza Hussein. But in DC, they don't lag behind. Batman has recently dubbed the local Batman in France an Algerian French name. He goes by Night Runner, I think. So that's in mainstream comics. And then also there's a lot of comics coming from the Muslim world that people might not be aware of, such as the local Malaysian comics master Lut, the 99 that Zarina mentioned.
Yes.
And the famous Palestinian political cartoonist Naji Ali. So there's a rich kind of tapestry of this, and even in the indie comic scene, of which Craig is a part. Hi, Craig. Might have met you once at a convention somewhere.
Yeah.
Fan of your work. But there's a writer named G. Willow Wilson. She's a white convert to Islam. She works for Vertigo Comics, or she writes for them on series like Cairo and Air.
So, Fawad, let me ask, do you have any problem or take pleasure when a big graphic novelist like Craig Thompson picks up the iconography of this sort of Arabian Nights realm and makes it his? Are you...
Well, you know, I'm a fan and a comics nerd, so I love comics for comics' sake, but then also as a Muslim comics enthusiast, I'm always interested to see it. I can totally see where Zarina mentions the ambivalence, because there have been so many depictions. And when you get into history, there's so many. You know, it goes back a long ways. The Arabian Nights themselves started as a very interesting East-West amalgamation in the 1700s when the French translations and Richard Burton's British translations of these disparate Eastern stories that just caught on like wildfire in the West, and became a foundation for our fantasy and science fiction genres, these genies and magic rings and all this stuff. But a lot of it was even invention from the start, where Burton's just making stuff up and adding it to the tradition. Now,
a long dance between civilizations here. Fawad Siddiqui in Pittsburgh, it's especially an honor to have you call in, and I appreciate it. If I may, let me take that piece to Zarina. I mean, you hear Craig Thompson embracing this, finding beauty in it, searching for redemption here, treating religions with a respectful investigation here, alongside some quite beyond religion issues as well. But what about this simple issue of the aesthetic that he's bringing in here? I mean, can he really avoid the traps that Edward Said talks about? Can, you know, are we forever going to come to this part of the world with genies and deserts and caravans? And you understand my question.
I do understand, and I thought a lot about this, and I'm actually concerned that I'm coming off as more critical of the text than I intend to, because I have to say I really loved it, and I read it once all the way through, and I'm sure I'll read it many more times because it's very complicated. My wish is that the exotic Orientalist imagery was just a little more ironic than it actually reads to me. That's what I wish, is that it's not totally clear that there is a desire to subvert some of it. In some ways, it's almost like he's using the force of those, the power of those Orientalist images to do narrative work for him, where kind of drive the plot in certain ways, and it's not critical enough for my personal taste. And there are certain traps that he falls into. So there is, they're kind of living in an Islamoland. Islam is kind of, as Edward Said would put it, Islam from top to bottom in some ways. Mm-hmm. Sort of Islam penetrates every element of their lives. Their sort of timelessness. These are Orientalist tropes, and I don't think that I obviously appreciate and really respect the amount of effort that Craig spent in trying to study the issue and to represent it in a complex way and to sort of work against this othering discourse that is at the core of Orientalism. And I do think intentions matter. I don't think this is like I don't think he's trying to be a provocateur. But there's just a couple moments where it's frustrating that, falling back on, like the woman when she sees a Western, the main character when she sees a Western woman without a veil, pulls her veil off. And those are sort of cliches that people like me get tired of, because, of course, if we've learned anything from the war on terror and our excursions in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it's not that Muslim women are going to rip their burqas off as soon as we get there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes,
so,
yes, we are.
Okay, so that's all.
Craig, what about the nature of desire? It's right at the heart of this. What did you learn in your journey through Habibi about the depths of desire and its nature?
Desire. Well, in terms of relationship, all my books sort of focus on two characters. They're carving out a shelter within each other in the midst of a cold, heartless world. And that theme definitely continues in Habibi. But it also goes to a next level, that you can't really find salvation in another. You first have to heal yourself from within. So Desire is both explored in its sort of aesthetic sort of sensuality, which is, part of some of these esoteric explorations, but also as a falsity and a form of idolatry, and that you first have to begin with yourself.
You quote the Prophet Muhammad here at the end of your orphan's prayer: "We have returned from the lesser jihad to the greater jihad." When asked, "What is the greater jihad?" he replied, "It is the struggle against oneself." It's right there, Craig.
Yes, that's the core, I think, of relationships, you know, and of course of these characters. They struggle so much with outside forces, but the ultimate battle for them as characters is internal.
It's been wonderful to be able to spend the time with you two investigating this. Listeners, if you haven't seen it yet, it is really a journey, not a child's journey, I'll say again, but quite a human journey through faiths and cultures and the human heart, all that is there. Zarina Graywall, joining us today from Yale, but from Princeton, New Jersey today, assistant professor at Yale, director and producer of By the Dawn's Early Light. Zarina, thank you so much. I hope we get to talk again. Thank you for joining us today.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much.
And Craig Thompson of Carnet de Voyage and Goodbye Chunky Rice and Blankets now of Habibi. Listeners, you can see illustrated panels from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Craig Thompson joining us today from San Francisco. Craig, thank you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom and Zarina. An honor.
Great to have you both. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from John McConnell and Sarah Mowad, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.